Carolyn Kramer-Gould. Joining me today is Dr. Andrew Kolarik, who is a cyber terrorism expert. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Can you start off by telling me a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm native to Northeast Ohio, born and raised here. I'm an independent information security consultant. I am an author on security books. I'm a researcher in technology, in particular patents. I'm an inventor. I own a design and utility patent. And most importantly, I'm a teacher of technology.
And do you teach here in Northeast Ohio?
At the moment, I'm not teaching at a university formally, but a lot of what I do in my job is transfer technology skills to employees, businesses, and so forth.
Okay. The big reason why you're here today, the only reason why we're really here today, is to talk about cyber terrorism. Can we start off with a definition of what cyber terrorism is?
Well, let's first start with terrorism.
Okay.
Because cyber terrorism is an extension of it. Terrorism, as opposed to information warfare, is about creating fear, period. Whether that means you blow up a subway, a school, kidnap people, threaten them, it's about creating fear for some social or political or even economic agenda. Now, cyber terrorism is the use of the global information infrastructure or cyberspace or the telecommunications infrastructure to facilitate terrorism. And to the most part, what we want to view cyber terrorism as is the use of communications and coordination between terrorist cells, intelligence gathering for target selection, propaganda, websites, videos showing people getting beheaded, accomplishments out in the field, and for recruitment, because if you've shown that you're actually making an impact in the world, you will get people who want to join something successful. And last, for fundraising, because a lot of the money that goes into terrorist financing, you have to show results, just like a business. If I'm going to sponsor a terrorist organization, I want to see results. And that's, cyberspace is being used for that whole communication coordination infrastructure.
When was the first act of cyber terrorism?
I would have to say, and the experts like to debate this. Some experts even say cyber terrorism is an illusion generated by certain corporations for profit and so forth. I would have to say that the beheadings that were videotaped and put out on websites would be the first validated use of cyber terrorism. That's not to say that emails and phone calls and satellite communications and so forth haven't occurred before that. But there was, I would say, a definitional line that got crossed where we clearly now can say cyber terrorism exists.
September 11th completely changed the way America and other countries view terrorism. How, and one of the things that people think of when they thought of those terrorists was that they were, you know, slummy, scummy, didn't have an education, you know, they were brought over direct from, maybe they went as high as eighth grade. You know, there's this image that people have in their minds of what a terrorist is like. Can you tell me, because I know that's not true, tell me what the terrorists that perpetrated September 11th, at least, and others are like.
Well, this notion that these are Bedouins riding on the back of camels, living in the desert, where there may be an element where they do hang out in the desert, or their origins or families from that regions or that lifestyle. Most of these folks are middle class, westernized, Western educated, advanced degreed, technical people. These are not ignorant people. They're not stupid people. They also are very well coordinated. They have clear objectives, and they're not afraid to use our own technologies against us, as seen with jetliners being turned into missiles.
You have written a book recently, and I know there's another one that just went to the publisher, but the book that got us talking is Your Managerial Guide for Handling Cyber Terrorism and Information Warfare, which was co-written by, and I don't know how to say this person's name.
Yancheski.
Okay. And this has been published by Idea Group Publishing for you. What caused you to write this book? What brought about this book being written?
Well, I was overseas when September 11th happened. And while people in America may have gone a little crazy, they were coming together. They were supporting each other. They were mobilizing each other and so forth. I was outside the country, and I got to witness the opposite. I got to witness the America had it coming. I got to witness the it's about time. This great hatred was manifested in that attack. And I decided at that point, if you don't step up and do something to help, then the people who want to hurt get to advance their agenda. So I sat down with Lech Yancheski, and we decided we were going to apply our particular skill sets to the terrorism issue.
When a listener here in Northeast Ohio hears this show, they're going to say, okay, cyber terrorism, damn, it doesn't affect me. I'm in Cleveland or Akron or Brunswick or Beechwood. That doesn't affect me and my small business.
In an indirect way, I would agree, mildly. What I would do is I would say to those people that the majority of our economic strength is founded on technology, in particular communications. Our democratic processes are founded on an open dialogue and discourse. Our ability to organize ourselves is all geared around communication. Our financial sectors, banking, electronics. How would you like the electrical grid to be out for a week? Well, there are a number of systems that can be accessed remotely. They're called SCADA systems that help control and coordinate railroads, lights, dams, power distribution facilities, etc., that electronically from somewhere else in the world could be accessed, changed, or disrupted. Here's another good one. You know, the Cleveland Clinic here in Cleveland, Ohio is exceptional. We get a lot of people from the Middle East who come here for heart surgery. If you were to hack into a database, the patient's database, and change their blood type before their surgery, that would be enough to get them killed. The electronic world is now part of what we do. So it's not just your business. It's not just the big picture. That's somebody else's problem. Your daily life can be disrupted. Let me also bring this to a little more personal impact. How would you like to be the individual whose identity was stolen, the credit card and driver's license, which was fabricated from your identity, used to rent the apartment to help build the bombs, to rent the truck, which was loaded with the bombs, which was then driven to the federal building and blow it up? Imagine how that would change your life. whether you were innocent or not. So it is up to all of us to recognize this is a very, very serious emerging problem. Now, the likelihood that you're the victim is small. But if you become the victim, it is horrific.
So you got me sold. How do I, as the manager of XYZ Corporation, what do I do to stop cyber terrorism from happening?
Well, there's a number of solutions, and they're fairly standard. The problem is a lot of people don't apply them. The first is physical security. If you don't have a secure facility, whether that be the entry, exit points, loading docks, your equipment. Let's say that I want access to your personnel database. Let's say that your key bank. Can I get into your computer server room, unplug one of your servers, and walk out the door? I don't need to electronically hack in if I can pick up a box and walk out the door. On the electronic security side, you have principles such as confidentiality, integrity, authentication, access control, audit trails, and non-repudiation. These are security terms. There are corresponding technologies that will make your data confidential, that will maintain your medical database so that no one without a proper authorization can change a blood type. Authentication. Who actually has the credentials to come in and use your resources? Access control. Once you're in the system, how do you control who has access to what areas? Audit trails. In the event that somebody does something they shouldn't have, how do you find out who did it? And non-repudiation, which I think a lot of politicians need to take note of, is irrefutable evidence that a transaction actually occurred. Using the current technology in a good orientation will do that. Also, security has two other components besides all this technology. The first is you have to configure all of that technology, and you have to continually update and maintain it. The last, which I think is the most important, is the people aspect. If a person doesn't want to do something to maintain a system, to maintain their own security or a company's security, very little can be done until after the fact, until you find out that something hasn't occurred. So working with people, training them, giving them good security policies and guidelines to operate around. Again, this is standard business practices.
Denial of service. What is, for those non-geek people out there, what is a denial of service attack?
Well, let's put it in human terms. Now, it's an electronic attack that overloads things. But if you were a teacher and you have 500 students, you have an order, you say one question at a time. Imagine if 500 people start talking to you all at once.
Overload.
Overload. And it's that simple. A denial of service attack has, in the past, successfully taken down Microsoft, Yahoo, eBay, all these big companies. Essentially, there are 500 million computers worldwide, 650 million internet subscribers, 24% is here in the U.S., 150 million internet servers. If you can hijack a small percentage of those computers and have them direct a communication at a given company or server or service, you then can make it unavailable. That's essentially a denial of service attack.
One of my family members did not use their passwords wisely and had one of their web pages taken. It was just taken away from them by a hijacker. And you know, we all laughed at him and said, you know, Goldilocks isn't a good password, and you need to sort of change that with some numbers and letters intermixed there, dear, so that they don't steal it again. Do cyber terrorists take over websites like that?
I'm not entirely sure that I would call them cyber terrorists. I think hacktivists, hacktivism. I think hackers and crackers. I think criminals might. There is a large number of politically motivated web defacements, such as the CIA had their web page defaced to the three initials I'm going to not mention on air. Other companies have had the same thing occur. The other thing is, if you can actually change a web page, you could put in links that redirect regular customers to a location they shouldn't be in, such as for online banking.
And that's the scams, that the latest spam scam is, you know, a supposed letter from a bank or from eBay wanting you to go update your financial information. And the link looks like it's actually taking you to, you know, this legitimate site. And in fact, it's taking you somewhere completely different.
Well, I actually, over the last couple of days, received a email from SkyBank. All very legitimate email addresses, wonderfully crafted HTML web page in the email, went to their site, you know, asking me to log into my account, add my password, because I always explore this stuff. I get myself into trouble periodically, and we'll talk about business continuity planning later.
Okay.
I get back up and running very quickly. And it actually took me to legitimate locations, but it added additional code which redirected my entry. Now, I don't have online banking, which would sound silly for a computer expert, but I don't use it. Not because it's not bad, but I recommend if you're going to use it, you keep a minimum balance. So in any event, I called SkyBank up and I said, you know, there's this wonderful little email, very well crafted. I think your investigation department needs to get involved. They said, yes, we've already been, you know, contacted by a large number of people and they're acting on it. I then went to the website to go look up the background information for who controls the server and who updated what and contact info. And the site had been taken down, and the contact information had been removed. I contacted the internet service provider that hosted that particular website, and they had no comment. They asked me to simply email the problem. So this sort of silliness goes on. Now, I wouldn't call any of that cyber terrorism unless the money taken from a scam like that is then turned over to a terrorist organization.
Okay. Domain name server attacks.
When you go to your browser and you want to type in, let's say, my website, www.andrewkolarik.com, so C-O-L-A-R-I-K, that's a lot easier than knowing the numbers of my IP location for my server.
192.168.whatever.
Et cetera. And I look at IP numbers as an internet phone number.
Right.
So instead of knowing the phone number on your cell phone, they now have voice activated where you say, call Andrew, and it enters the number. Well, a domain name server is just that. Now, if you can break into that server and change the address that that number is directing you to, say again, a banking operation, instead gets redirected to a spoofed site, you can collect a lot of information and a lot of numbers and ultimately perhaps money. So that's a domain name server attack. You also have routing vulnerabilities. Routers are little switches that send all the packets of the internet through them. They read the packet and forward it to the appropriate address. If you can get into the router and change or put a special filter or redirect into it, you can redirect traffic where it doesn't belong.
So are cyber terrorists doing this stuff? Or is it, you know, we always hear about the kids in Europe that are just bored and they're having a good time seeing if they can hack.
There is a self-proclaimed cyber jihadist organization called the Osama bin Laden group. And these folks have declared jihad electronically. Any anti-terrorism sites they go after, take down the websites, attack electronically the people who run the sites, and essentially harass and distribute their silliness. Now, I don't know if they're directly tied to an Al-Qaeda organization, but this is very serious. Now, let's take a look at perhaps a bigger issue rather than the specifics. There's a company called RipTech that Symantec bought a couple years ago, and they produce very, very detailed reports of the various attacks on companies and sectors and so forth. And of the top three industries, power and energy was number one. Financial services, which I thought would be number one, was number two, followed by high tech, so there's a lot of criminal theft of intellectual property, and then nonprofits. And nonprofits probably because their security is not always as good.
So why are they going after power and energy before banks?
Because this is their way of attacking our economic infrastructure without being here. You don't need to send a suicide bomber to a power plant to bring it down. If you can break in electronically, you can re-divert, turn off, change settings, cause overloads, all kinds of stuff. Now, these attacks that were reported, the interesting part is the location of where these attacks came from. In order, highest rank, rank number one, Peru, which is narco-terrorism, Iran, number two, Kuwait, number three, United Arab Emirates, number four, Nigeria, number five, Saudi Arabia, number six, Croatia, number seven, Vietnam, number eight, Egypt, number nine. U.S. foreign policy has been very active in those countries, even though we have treaties with their governments. The population is orchestrating these types of attacks.
We have 5 minutes left, believe it or not. talk to me about business continuity planning. We've talked about what the problems are that can happen. How can businesses stop it?
Well, the first thing is you need to identify what your critical assets are. In order for you to stay in business, what are your critical assets? Is it your server? Is it your information? Is it your building? Your people? That's number one. Identify the high priority potential targets. Number two, you have to back things up. And you have to do so in a manner that you can restore it quickly. I have many clients who have had attacks prior to my engagement, and they've lost all of their infrastructure. Customers then call asking for something, whatever that customer, regular customers, And they have to tell them, our server is down. Well, in today's world, customers don't wait. You have to be up and running. So this leads to remote operations. If, you know, whether it's a terrorist or a natural occurrence such as a fire, or even unnatural in an arson case, remote operations electronically can be established very easily so that you can move your people home, connect via the internet or direct dial-up, and make use of the current operation information. You can continue to do business while you get things back up and running.
How much money do companies spend? We have 3 minutes left. How much money can companies spend, do companies spend on this important part of their business?
At the moment, a lot of money goes into having several computer specialists, servers, upgrades, maintenance. But as far as business continuity planning, a very, very small number of companies are actively doing it. And usually they are high service, large corporations. When was the last time you couldn't get a circuit to make a phone call? As a result, same thing with your information resources. If it's critical, they're doing it. If they don't feel that it's critical, they're not.
I know you have a website up. You told me about it, and you also have a special deal for my listeners.
Yes. For the listeners of Greater Cleveland Forum, my publisher, Idea Group Publishing, and myself are offering a 25% discount for the managerial guide for handling cyber terrorism and information warfare. If you want this discount, go to my website at www.anderewcolarik.com, and on my homepage, down at the bottom, you'll see a small little blue genie, and right below it will be the discount form. Print that out, fax it to the publisher, and take 25% off.
And that's of Managerial Guide for Handling Cyber Terrorism and Information Warfare.
Yes.
But I know you have another book that's just gone to the publishers. Tell me about the new book that's coming out.
I have a new book called Cyber Terrorism, Political and Economic Implications, that go heavily into the entire global information infrastructure and how we are dependent on computers. Our gross domestic product has been tied directly to this economic infrastructure. The latest and greatest cyber attacks and use of computers by cyber terrorism and terrorists alike, as well as all the various sector and industries, how they use information and why it's critical that they need to mobilize and start using good security practices.
We have 30 seconds left. How many companies call you in? What's your average client base look like? How big?
Well, my clients range from small to large. I don't take on a lot of clients all at once. I'm generally very individually focused. So if a client wants me to come in, I do an audit, I talk to their personnel, I do a complete top-down and bottom-up analysis, and I dedicate myself solely to one customer at a time if I possibly can. If you miss something in this business, it'll come back to haunt your client. And my business approach is to simply stay focused.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Caroline.
Again, I was talking with Dr. Andrew Kolarik, who is a cyber terrorism expert.